We are in Deuteronomy 12. Okay? And this is Deuteronomy 12 starts the specific stipulations, which last week we talked about. Oh, and you are going to want to listen to last week, Terry, because I went through and wrote down on the board.
No, actually, I saw it.
Oh, you did. Okay. Yes. So all the specific stipulations tie back to the Ten Commandments, and they do it in order. Okay, so chapter 12 is going to be about command 1. Chapter 13 is going to be about command 2.
Oh, an entire chapter is on each one.
Yeah. And it's not even chapter. Is it still here?
It's like,
did Kyle rewrite?
Like, some are multiple chapters. Some are.
Here, Kyle, just a second. Well, Kyle didn't erase it.
Oh, he didn't erase it. Okay.
All right, so this is how, so the specific stipulations are the Ten Commandments, how they are Israel, this is important, how Israel was to apply them in their practical life and in order. Okay, so command 1, chapter 12, command 2, 13, command 3 is not even a whole chapter, it's just 1 to 21. Okay, now, and I also said there's discussion, especially down in this area, of how exactly it breaks out. Okay, so this might, don't take this as gospel truth. Okay, there are different scholars that will break it up just a tiny bit different. Okay, but the main idea is that the specific stipulations break down the Ten Commandments in order. Okay, so chapter 12 is about command 1, which is to have no other gods. And we talked about last week how the very first thing they're commanded to do is to go into Canaan and destroy all false religion. So the first way that you make God, you have no other gods before you, is you go into the land and you destroy all the other gods. Okay? All their stuff, all the mountains, everything. Okay? Yes. It's similar to the 1 Corinthians. Yes. Okay, then in chapter 12, so we only did chapter 12, 1 to 14, okay? In that passage, three different times, verse 5, verse 11, and verse 14, and then it's going to be also later in the chapter, but in that section, three times, it talks about you are to worship God in the place that he chooses. Okay, the Canaanites worshipped their gods under any tree, on any hill, or any mountain, any place they wanted to erect a shrine to their god, they could, and they did. Okay, so it was here, there, and everywhere. God says, no, Israel, you are to be different. You are going to worship me in one place, and it's going to be the place that I choose. Now remember, this is Deuteronomy, they're not in the land yet. Okay, so they don't know, I mean, technically, if they know their Abrahamic history, they should know about Jerusalem. However, God has not chosen that place yet. Okay, so it is going to become Jerusalem. Israel doesn't know that yet. Okay, but three times he says, one place you worship, and it's going to be the place that God chooses. Okay, so that's where we ended last week. And I said this week we would start off with, starting in Genesis, a theology of Jerusalem. Why is Jerusalem so significant? Okay, why do we care? I mean, and we know it goes all the way to Revelation because God's going to give us a new Jerusalem, right? A new Jerusalem's going to come down out of heaven, right? After the millennium and in the eternal state, Jerusalem is still going to exist. Okay, so obviously Jerusalem is very important. Deuteronomy 12 tells us why. Okay, so the point of Jerusalem is to proclaim to the world that this is the center of everything. This is where God lives and where God dwells. Okay, there is only one God, and he is the center of the entire world. And that's why Israel will always be in the news, because Israel is still the center of everything. Okay, Abner calls it the middle of everywhere. Okay, in that area, to go anywhere, you got to go through Israel. Okay. God is the center of everything Israel does, even geographically. He's going to pick one spot, and all of Israel, no matter where they live, have to travel to that one spot to worship God. So that Jerusalem, that one spot, proclaims that there is one God and one way to worship. And he is supreme and has authority over all. He dictates that his people worship him the way he wants. Okay? So, Jerusalem vertically establishes who God is. There's one God, strict monotheism. So Jerusalem, the city itself, is a proclamation of command number one. There are no other gods. Jerusalem itself is a proclamation to the world that there are no other gods. Okay? Jerusalem is like a big flag, a big symbol for what Israel was supposed to proclaim to the world. Okay? Horizontally, affecting people, Jerusalem is to establish that God's reign, Yahweh's reign, is not just over Israel, but over the entire earth. Okay, he dominates the nations, and the nations are all going to eventually come to Jerusalem to worship, because this is where God is. Okay, so Jerusalem is going to be set up to proclaim there is only one God, and he is not God of just Israel, he is God of the nations. Okay, his authority spreads over the entire earth. Okay, so this starts in Genesis, believe it or not. Can someone read for me Genesis 2, 10 to 14?
Now a river flowed out of Eden to water the garden, and from there it divided and became four rivers. The name of the first was Pishon. It flows around the whole land of Hivalah, where there is gold. The gold of that land is good. The bdellium and the onyx stone are there. The name of the second river is Gihon. It flows around the whole land of Cush. The name of the third river is the Tigris. It flows east of Assyria. And the fourth river is the Euphrates.
Okay, I don't know if you guys remember all the way back to Genesis, which was a lot, especially Genesis 2 was a very long time ago. Okay, but God plants a garden, and it's Eden. And from the Garden of Eden flow these four rivers that basically water the whole earth. Okay, so, and Eden is where God sets up the first man and the first woman. And what is their job?
Tend
the garden and have dominion over what? The whole earth. Their dominion is over everything. Adam was right to name the animals, but God gives dominion over the whole earth to Adam and Eve, okay? And their dwelling place is the Garden of Eden. So the Garden of Eden is the first capital of the world, okay? What happens in Genesis 3? Sin, and where did they get kicked out of?
The garden,
right? And we've talked about, they lose the garden, and what's our whole goal? Get back to the garden, right? We want to get back to the garden because that's where things were right, okay? Garden of Eden, first capital of the world. In the fall, we lose that capital. Adam and Eve are never allowed back in, okay? So in redemptive history, there has to be another what?
Capital.
There has to be another capital of the world. Something has to replace Eden, okay? And what's that going to be?
Jerusalem.
Okay, so we have the Garden of Eden. We're always trying to get back to the Garden of Eden. We have, because of the fall, we need a new capital. We need something to make it right. Okay, Genesis 14. Can someone read for me verses 18 to 20? Genesis 14, 18 to 20. Okay, so now we have Melchizedek. And where is he from? King of Salem, okay, which is peace. Okay, Salem is another name for Jerusalem, okay? So Melchizedek is not only king, but he is also what?
Priest
of God Most High, of Yahweh, okay? He is a king and a priest of God. And this is after Lot gets captured, right? And Abram goes up to rescue Lot, right? And the king of Sodom, right? This is before Sodom and Gomorrah destroyed, right? And on the way back, he runs into this Melchizedek, king of Salem, right? And Melchizedek ends up teaching Abram about God, because Melchizedek calls God, God Most High. Abram's never called him that before. And then if you just look down, verse 22, Abram said to the king of Sodom, I have sworn to the Lord, God Most High, right? So he takes that title for God, and he got it from Melchizedek. So even in the time of Abram, God is worshipped in Jerusalem. Now, by the time we get to Joshua, right, well, actually, by the time we get to 2 Samuel, Jerusalem is inhabited by the Jebusites, okay? Not worshipers of God. But at least at this point in time, Jerusalem is a center where you have a king who is also a priest, and there is the worship of God, okay? The true God. And Melchizedek, this priest king, teaches Abram about who God is. And that's also why Abram, if you remember, gives a tithe to Melchizedek. He gives a tenth of all he has. Okay? Then, if you flip forward really quick, Psalm 110. Can someone read for me verse 4? Psalm 110, verse 4. Okay, because we are New Testament saints, who do we know this is referring to? Who?
Jesus,
okay? Jesus, we know, is going to be our high priest. But is he of the tribe of Levi? No, he's the tribe of Judah. Okay, so how in the world is he going to be high priest? Because God said only those of the tribe of Levi, specifically only descendants of Aaron, specifically only descendants of Phinehas, are going to be high priests. Okay? Jesus is none of those. He's of the tribe of Judah, okay? Here it says Jesus is going to be priest according to the order of Melchizedek. Melchizedek was king and priest, and he was priest of the Most High God in Jerusalem. This is, Melchizedek wasn't a pre-incarnate Christ, but he is a picture of what Christ is going to be in the New Testament. And Melchizedek rules from Jerusalem, okay? Then, Deuteronomy 12, where we are right now. We learn that wherever it is that God's going to choose, it is going to be a proclamation to the world that there is one God and he has authority over all. And Israel is going to order their entire life around this place. Okay, there is only one place that they are allowed to go to make sacrifice to God. Okay, so is Jerusalem is going to proclaim that God is supreme and has all authority. Okay, then we get Joshua, and they conquer the land, and Judges, and things go crazy, okay? And the Ark of the Tabernacle is in Shiloh for a while, okay? And it goes different places. Now, I said last week that even when the Tabernacle is not in Jerusalem, there is still only one place where Israel can go, right? Wherever that Tabernacle is. So even if the Tabernacle gets moved, now they have a different one place, okay? But the Tabernacle eventually ends up in Jerusalem. So someone read for me 2 Samuel chapter 5, verses 6 through 10. This is when David conquers Jerusalem. 2 Samuel 5, verse 6 through 10.
Then the king and his men went to Jerusalem against the Jebusites, the inhabitants of the land, and they said to David, "You shall not come in here, but the blind and the lame will turn you away, thinking David cannot enter here. Nevertheless, David captured the fortress of Zion, that is the city of David. And David said on that day, whoever would strike down the Jebusites, let him reach the lame and the blind, who are hated by David's soul, through the water tunnel. Therefore they say, the blind or the lame shall not come into the house. Then David lived in the fortress and called it the city of David. And David built all around from Milo and inward. And David became greater and greater, and Yahweh, the God of hosts, was with him."
Okay, so this is when David conquers Jerusalem. It's owned by the Jebusites. They're like, psh, it's so fortified. You can't get in here. Even our blind and lame can defend the city, right? They sneak in through the water tunnel, and David's like, yeah, your blind and lame did a great job, okay? And he basically gets rid of the blind and the lame, right? Therefore, they say the blind or the lame shall not come into the house, okay? So that was David's revenge against the Jebusites, to get rid of all the blind and the lame, because those were the ones that were supposed to defend the city, and yet David conquers the city, okay? Then if you just turn a couple page or two over, 2 Samuel 6, 12 to 15.
David was dancing before the Lord with all his might, and David was wearing a linen ephod. Then, so David and all his house of Israel were bringing up the ark of the Lord and shouting, and the sound of the trumpet.
Okay, so this is, if you remember, they tried to move the ark, right? And then, but they moved it the wrong way, not the way God said, on the back of a cart, right? And it tips, and whatever the guy's name was reached out his hand to touch it, and then he dies, right? And so everyone's like, we want nothing to do with this. And they happen to be next to the house of Obed-Edom, okay? So David's like, you get the ark. Nobody else wants it, right? And so then here, David's told, hey, God's really blessed him. Ark of the Covenant is there. And so finally, David brings the ark and the tabernacle into Jerusalem, okay? And this is its final resting place, okay? So the ark is brought into Jerusalem. Then fast forward to Solomon, right? So it took the king, the true king of Israel, to set up the capital of Israel, which is Jerusalem, right? Saul is not the true king because Saul was chosen by the people, not by God. David was God's choice, okay? So it was David then who sets up the capital, which is Jerusalem. Now it's going to be Solomon who turns the tabernacle into a temple, okay? So 1 Kings 8, we're not going to read it, but it's when the Ark of the Covenant is taken into the temple. So Solomon has constructed the temple, and the Ark of the Covenant is brought into the Holy of Holies. Okay, and there it stayed until we don't really know what happened to it. Okay, that's right, in America somewhere. Okay, then 1 Kings 10. Somebody read for me 1 Kings 10, verses 1 to 10. Yep.
Now when the queen of Sheba heard about the fame of Solomon concerning the name of the Lord, she came to test him with difficult questions. So she came to Jerusalem with a very large retinue, with camels carrying spices and very much gold and precious stones. When she came to Solomon, she spoke with him about all that was in her heart. Solomon answered all her questions. Nothing was hidden from the king, which he did not explain to her. When the queen of Sheba perceived all the wisdom of Solomon, the house he had built, the food of his table, the seating of his servants, the attendance of his waiters and their attire, his cupbearers, and his stairway by which he went up to the house of the Lord, there was no more spirit in her. Then she said to the king, it was a true report which I heard in my own land about your words and your wisdom. Nevertheless, I did not believe the reports until I came, that my eyes had seen it. And behold, the half was not told me. You exceed in wisdom and prosperity the report which I heard. How blessed are your men, how blessed are these your servants who stand before you continually and hear your wisdom. Blessed be the Lord your God who delighted in you to set you on the throne of Israel, because the Lord loved Israel forever. Therefore he made you king to do justice and righteousness. Mm. She gave the king 120 talents of gold and a very great amount of spices and precious stones. Never again did such abundance of spices come in as that which the queen of Sheba gave King Solomon.
Okay, so here we have the Queen of Sheba coming to where?
Jerusalem,
right? The fame of the Lord is spreading, and the nations are starting to come, right? Verse 1, chapter 10, verse 1 of 1 Kings. Now, when the Queen of Sheba heard about the fame of Solomon concerning the name of the Lord. So you cannot divorce Solomon and his wisdom from God, right? Because God is the source of Solomon's wisdom and Solomon's great power and fame. So the nations are starting to come to Jerusalem and realize that this God of Israel, there's something different here, Okay, so she comes to see if everything's all cracked up to be, you know, what people have said it is, and she says, it exceeded all my expectations. You are far wiser than I ever thought. Okay? But we know Israel's history, right? We have only, well, technically three kings of the United Kingdom, if you count Saul, really two kings of the United Kingdom, right? And then everything falls apart, okay? Because Solomon, we talked about, I think that was last week, right? Kings were not supposed to multiply women, gold, or horses, right? Solomon basically does all three, right? So you know Solomon's not going to last, okay? And the judgment really falls on his son, who listens to his friends instead of the wise counselors and destroys Israel. Okay, it all falls apart. In 586 BC, Judah goes into exile and Jerusalem falls, okay, to Babylon. Okay, so then enter the prophets. Let's turn to Micah. Can someone read for me Micah 3:12 and Micah 4, 1 and 2? 3:12 is the last verse of chapter 3 and then the first two verses of chapter 4. Micah 3:12 through 4:2. Oh, that's Malachi, not Micah.
I will cut off sorceries from your hand and you will have
Micah 3:12.
Sorry.
That's okay. Okay, just pause right there, okay? So this is talking about the rulers of Israel, okay? Because they have been awful, because they have not followed God's rules, because they have not upheld justice and righteousness, what's going to happen? Jerusalem, the city that is supposed to point to the supremacy and monotheism of God himself, is going to become a heap of ruins, okay? Mountain, the temple, will become high places of a forest. Like, it will all be ruined, okay? You turn the page or go to the next chapter, Micah 4, 1 and 2.
And it will come about in the last day that the mountain of the house of the Lord will be established as the chief of the mountains. It will be raised above the hills, and the peoples will stream to it. And many nations will come and say, come and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord and to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us about his ways, that we may walk in his paths. For from Zion will go forth the law. Even the word of the Lord from Jerusalem.
So in the book of Micah, it's like, you rulers, you're awful. You are going to bring about the ruin of Jerusalem. It's going to be rubble. And then in the next breath, what does Micah say?
But
hope is not all lost. In the end, in the last days, what's going to happen to Jerusalem? Who's going to go there?
The throngs from the world.
Right, the nations. Jerusalem will be established as the capital of the world and the nations will come, right? And they will say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord that he may teach us about his ways. The nations are going to come to Jerusalem to learn about this supreme God who has authority over all. So in one breath, Micah is saying, Jerusalem, you're done for. Because your rulers are evil, you will be a heap of ruins. But God has a plan, and Jerusalem will not stay a heap of ruins, okay? There is coming a day when Jerusalem will be the capital of the world and the nations will stream to it.
Correct.
Okay? Then you get all the prophets, and there's tons of references, okay? We're not going to read all of them, but let's go to Zechariah 8. I mean, I don't even have all of them here. Zechariah 8:20-23.
Thus says the Lord of hosts, it will yet be that peoples will come, even the inhabitants of many cities. The inhabitants of one will go to another, saying, let us go at once to entreat the favor of the Lord and to seek the Lord of hosts. I will also go. So many people from mighty nations will come to seek the Lord of hosts in Jerusalem and to entreat the favor of the Lord. Thus says the Lord of hosts, in those days 10 men from all the nations will grasp the garment of a Jew, saying, let us go with you, for we have heard that God is with you.
Yeah, think of that. 10 men will grasp the garment of a Jew. That has never happened in history before. Not to say, hey, come lead the way, right? That's exactly right, okay? But a day is going to come when the inhabitants of the world are going to look at the Jews and say, you have the truth, and we want to go to Jerusalem. Take us to that one place where you worship your God and teach us. Okay? Isaiah 2, 1 through 4. Can someone read me that? Isaiah 2. One through four. Well, you get in the prophets, and then some of them are small. And
the word which, two, one to
four. Yes.
The word which Isaiah the son of Amoz saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem, now it will come about that in the last days the mountain of the house of the Lord will be established as the chief of the mountains and will be raised above the hills, and all the nations will stream to it. And many people will come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us concerning his ways, and that we may walk in his paths. For the law will go forth from Zion, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. And he will judge between the nations. He will render decisions for many peoples, and they will hammer their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not lift up sword against nation, and never again will they learn war.
Okay, so this again, Jerusalem is going to be the center. And in my Bible, I circled all the times it says will. Okay, this is an established fact. This is not hope. This is not wishful thinking on behalf of the Jews. This is something God has said will happen. And when God says it, it happens. So it hasn't happened yet, but I mean, now it will come about in the last days. The mountain, the house of the Lord will be established. I mean, it's all through that passage. Will. Okay, this is something that is going to be done. God is going to dwell in Jerusalem, and Jerusalem is going to be the center of the world, and from Jerusalem is going to emanate peace, right? You're going to hammer your swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. There will be no more war. And this all stems from Jerusalem, the center of the world. Okay, one more in the prophets, then we'll move on to the New Testament. Zephaniah 3, 14 to 20. Zephaniah 3:14-20. This is the very end of the book of Zephaniah.
Shout for joy, O daughter of Zion.
Nope. Zephaniah 3:14. Oh, sorry. Yes, I was looking at the wrong one. Sorry. My fault.
Cleared away your enemies. The King of Israel, the Lord, is in your midst. You will fear disaster no more. In that day it will be said to Jerusalem, do not be afraid, O Zion. Do not let your hands fall limp. The Lord your God is in your midst. A victorious warrior, he will exalt over you with joy. He will be quiet in his love. He will rejoice over you with shouts of joy. I will keep going.
Yeah, through 20. Okay, think about how often God was pleased with Jerusalem. Not very much. I mean, you have David and Solomon, and even those two kings, which are good kings and of the United Kingdom, they still don't obey God's word. They still don't obey God's law. And then you get Rehoboam and Jeroboam, right? And then you get disaster. And then there were some kings that you know, discovered God's law, Josiah, right, and bring about reforms, but it is all very short-lived, okay? But here in Zephaniah, God is going to exult over Jerusalem, right? They will be quiet in his love. He's going to rejoice over you with shouts of joy, right? This has not happened. But this is the hope of Jerusalem. And this is how it should have been from the beginning. This is what Deuteronomy 12 is saying. I'm going to pick one spot. You are all going to come worship there because you are going to be example to the nations that I am the only God. And this is my dwelling place. This is where I am. Okay? Now, we know Israel never does anything very well. Okay, and they did not uphold Jerusalem very well, right? When there are reforms in the kings, what do they have to do? They have to take down all the high places again, the thing that God commanded them in Deuteronomy 12 to do with the Canaanites. Well, now that Israel's been in the land for how many years, there should be no more high places. But the people always revert to worshiping other gods. Okay, so this is also why Ezra and Nehemiah are very important. Okay, so after the exile, right, they go to Babylon, they're in exile, then they come back. Ezra, what's their purpose? They want to rebuild what? The temple in Jerusalem. Nehemiah, what are they rebuilding? The wall of Jerusalem. They're not worried about any other town, right? Ezra and Nehemiah are concerned with Jerusalem. Why? Because Jerusalem is the flag, the symbol to the world that there is only one God. Okay? This is why Jerusalem is so important. This is why Jerusalem has to be rebuilt. This is why when they come back, they're not worried about going back to their farms and figuring out their own little towns. They have to come back to Jerusalem. Jerusalem has to be the first thing that is rebuilt. Okay? Because it proclaims to the world that God is still supreme. He has judged his nation, but then he is bringing them back and they are rebuilding the capital because there is still only one God and he still has all authority over the nations. Jerusalem is very important. Okay.
I think it's interesting that in some of these, it talks about just a very small word, up.
Mm-hmm.
It's on a high hill up to Jerusalem.
Right.
Yeah,
it doesn't matter what direction you're coming from.
Yes.
Yeah.
If you're coming from the Dead Sea, it's way up. You know, you're like riding in the bus. I remember riding in the bus, leaning back because we were, you know, you go up.
Yep.
And the Psalms and everything. In the Psalms, we go up to Jerusalem, Psalm 129.
Yep.
121.
Yep.
It's just interesting.
Yep. Yep.
It's on a high hill.
Right. Yes. Yep. You always go up to Jerusalem. Okay. To reestablish Jerusalem, right? We need a new king, okay? King David established Jerusalem first time around, okay? Obviously, it didn't work, okay? So to reestablish Jerusalem, we need a new king. And we know who that new king is. It's Jesus, okay? So let's go to Matthew 21, which is the triumphal entry, when Jesus enters Jerusalem as king. He enters Jerusalem as king. They all say, Hosanna, right? He goes into the temple. He overthrows the temple a second time, right? Okay, someone read for me Matthew 21, verse 14. This is what Jesus does right after he cleanses the temple a second time.
And the blind and the lame came to him in the temple, and he healed them.
Okay, who did he heal? The blind and the lame. Where did we talk about the blind and the lame today? Yes? Who wanted
that were,
that's right. David got rid of the blind and the lame when he conquered Jerusalem. Jesus got rid of the blind and the lame when he conquered Jerusalem. He comes in as king, and one of the first things he does after the triumphal entry, he cleanses the temple, and then he heals the blind and the lame because nobody's going to keep him out. Okay, he is repeating what David did in 2 Samuel 5. Right. Well, David couldn't. Yes, Jesus did it the better way. But now there are no more blind and lame in Jerusalem because Jesus heals them. Okay, so it looks like Jesus is reconquering Jerusalem, except he doesn't, right? I mean, he does, but he doesn't. He comes in as conquering king. He gets rid of the blind and the lame. And what happens a week later? They kill him on the cross. So then you have Matthew 24 and 25. This is the Olivet Discourse. Okay? Jesus is headed back out of Jerusalem. And his disciples are kind of like, what are you doing? Like, this is your moment. They hailed you as conquering king, right? When you came in on the triumphal entry, right? And the point is, Jesus is saying, this is not the time. I will be back and I will conquer Jerusalem, but it's not now. Okay? It's not now. The conquering, the true conquering, though, starts where? At the cross. At the cross, right? Because Jesus has to die first. Because unless our vertical problem is solved, we can never have the horizontal blessings. So unless God solves our vertical problem with him, Jerusalem can never be the center of the world to bless the whole world and the nations all come streaming in, right? God has to take care of our vertical problem first. So Jesus had to die on the cross first before he could truly come in and truly conquer Jerusalem in the way that his disciples always wanted him to, right? So the conquering truly starts at the cross, but of course the disciples didn't understand it at that point, okay? Then we know, fast forward in history, Jesus dies, 70 AD, what happens to Jerusalem? Pew, Titus wipes it out. The temple, everything, demolished, right? Okay, it hasn't been reestablished. I mean, there were always people there, right? But really reestablished until recently. But it won't be reestablished, right, until Christ returns. Okay, so Christ is going to rule from Jerusalem during the millennial kingdom and is going to fulfill all those prophecies that we read in the prophets. Okay, but that is not even the end of Jerusalem. Okay, can someone read for me Revelation 21? Well, this is a long chunk, so let me just see if I can shorten it. Revelation, if I can get there. Yeah. Okay, why don't you just read for me Revelation 21, 9 to 14.
Then one of the seven angels who have the seven bowls full of the seven last plagues came and spoke with me, saying, come here, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb. And he carried me away in the spirit to a great and high mountain and showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God. Having the glory of God, her brilliance was like precious stone, as a stone of crystal clear jasper. It had a great and high wall. It had 12 gates, and at those gates 12 angels. And names have been written on those gates, which are the names of the 12 tribes of the sons of Israel. There were 3 gates on the east, and 3 gates on the north, and 3 gates on the south, and 3 gates on the west. And the wall of the city had 12 foundation stones, and on them were the 12 names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb.
Okay, so in the end, in the new heavens, in the new earth, we are going to get a new Jerusalem. And there are 12 gates for the 12 tribes, and there are 12 foundation stones for the 12 apostles, right? The new Jerusalem is going to be a ginormous museum commemorating redemptive history. Okay, for all of eternity, the point of Jerusalem is that we will never forget what God has done for us. Okay, it is going to be a museum pointing to God and what he did to redeem us. And that is always what Jerusalem has been. Okay, from the very beginning, Jerusalem is to point man to God, that there is one God, and that he is ruler over all the earth, and he has all authority. And that's what the new Jerusalem is going to help us remember. Now, maybe we don't, I would assume we don't forget in all of eternity being in the perfect state. But regardless, this is what the purpose of Jerusalem will be. It will be a commemoration to all God has done in redemptive history. Questions? But just not too hard of questions, or I probably won't be able to answer them. Questions about Jerusalem.
Well, it's interesting when you go on in that chapter.
Yep.
There's no temple in it.
Correct.
The Lord God, the Almighty, and the Lamb are in the temple.
That's right, because this is his dwelling place. Yep. Because God will finally truly dwell with man. Okay.
That is the glory of the new Jerusalem.
Right. Right. Good. Any other questions? Did that all make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, it's so interesting to go back and tie in the prophets.
Yep.
I mean, I know there's a gazillion.
Oh, there's a gazillion more.
Because we've been doing the 12 prophets, minor prophets, and every week it points to what's coming.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Well, and Jerusalem is always very prominent. Right. There's. Yep, that's okay.
This is the new thing about the David Jebusites. Why did he specifically mention the blind and the lame? Because they said. Because
they taunted him.
They taunted him with that.
Yes.
Because it sounds like he's just singling them out like meanly. Like,
right.
Why do you single out the
warriors?
Oh,
yeah. Right. But I think it's because they taunted him and say, we're so secure that even the weakest of the weak are going to keep you out, David, you know, and he's like, I'll show you. Right. And he conquers them and gets rid of all the blind and the lame. Right. Then Jesus comes and does it better. Right. Jesus always does it better. Right. Because David is a type of Christ. But in David, we see much failure. Okay. And Jesus always does it better. But it's just an interesting, you know, thing to notice that when Jesus enters Jerusalem, you know, what's one of the first things he does? Heals the blind and the lame. Well,
he cleanses the temple.
Right, right. One of the first things he does. But yes, he cleanses the temple first. Good. Any other questions? All right. We will finish Deuteronomy 12. So if you go back to Deuteronomy 12. Can someone read for me the rest of the chapter? So that's Deuteronomy 12, 15 to 31.
However, you may sacrifice and eat meat within any of your gates, whatever you desire, according to the blessing of Yahweh your God, which he has given you. The unclean and the clean may eat of it, as of the gazelle and the deer. Only you shall not eat the blood. You are to pour it out on the ground like water. You are not allowed to eat within your gates the tithe of your grain, or new wine or oil, for the firstborn of your herd or flock, or of any of your votive offerings which you vow, or your freewill offerings, or the contribution of your hand. But you shall eat them before Yahweh your God in the place which Yahweh your God will choose, you and your son and daughter, and your male and female servants, and the Levite who is within your gates, and you shall be glad before Yahweh your God in all that you send forth your hand to do. Beware lest you forsake the Levite all your days upon your land. When Yahweh your God enlarges your territory as he has promised you, and you say, I will eat meat because you desire to eat meat, then you may eat meat, whatever you desire. If the place where Yahweh your God chooses to set his name is too far away from you, then you may sacrifice of your herd and flock, which Yahweh has given you, as I have commanded you, and you may eat within your gates whatever you desire. Just as a gazelle or a deer is eaten, so you will eat it. The unclean and the clean alike may eat of it. Only be strong in yourselves not to eat the blood, for the blood is the life, and you shall not eat the life with the flesh. You shall not eat it. You shall pour it out on the ground like water. You shall not eat it, so that it may be well with you and your sons after you, or you will be doing what is right in the sight of Yahweh. Only your holy things which you may have and your votive offerings you shall take and go to the place which Yahweh chooses. And you shall offer your burnt offerings and the flesh and the blood and on the altar of Yahweh your God. And the blood of your sacrifices shall be poured out on the altar of Yahweh your God. And you shall eat the flesh. Be careful to listen to all these words which I command you, so that it may be well with you and your sons after you forever. For you will be doing what is good and right in the sight of Yahweh your God. When Yahweh your God cuts off before you the nations which you are going to dispossess, and you dispossess them and inhabit their land, beware lest you be ensnared to follow them after they are destroyed before you, and lest you inquire after their gods, saying, how do these nations serve their gods that I also may do likewise? You shall not do thus toward Yahweh your God, for every abominable act which Yahweh hates, they have been done for their gods, for they even burn their sons and daughters in the fire to their gods. Whatever I am commanding you, you shall be careful to do. You shall not add to it or nor take away from it.
Okay, so when they enter the land, this is a situation unique to being in the promised land. Okay, do we remember when did Israel eat meat, except for the quail, before this? Do you remember how they would eat meat from Leviticus?
In the offerings.
Yes, they would make a fellowship offering, right? In a fellowship offering, you would come to the temple, you would bring your ox or your lamb or whatever, and you would offer it, and part of it would be burnt to God, part of it would be given to the priests, and then remember, you and your family and your friends and anyone who was clean could share of it. This works when you're all big, one big massive tribe, and the tabernacle is in the center of everything, right? When you're wandering through the wilderness, because everybody's all together, the tabernacle is always in the middle of everything. So if you want to eat your lamb, then you just bring it to the tabernacle and you offer it as a fellowship offering to God. Okay? When you are in Canaan and God says, now there's only one place that you can worship me, only one place where you can offer sacrifice, this is going to create a little bit of trouble, right? Because let's say you want to eat meat Friday night. Well, if you're all the way up in Galilee, you're not going to journey all the way down to Jerusalem to offer your ox to have a fellowship offering, okay? So God makes an exception. This is just a very practical life law, okay? So they can eat meat in their cities, okay? Verse 15, however, you may slaughter and eat meat within any of your gates, whatever you desire. Anytime you want to eat meat, you can kill the animal so long as it's clean, and you may eat it. And notice, this is not a true sacrifice, like a sacrifice to God, because, end of verse 15, the unclean and the clean may eat it. Okay, because this is not a sacrifice to God, doesn't matter if you're clean or unclean, right? If you're a woman on your period, you can still have a steak, okay? Because it doesn't matter, because this is just meat for sustenance. This is not an offering, a gift to God, okay? God will bless them, and they can eat meat without traveling to Jerusalem to offer it, right? And here it talks specifically about the gazelle and the deer. These are two animals that were clean, right? They have the hoof and they chew the cud, but they are not sacrificial animals. These wouldn't be animals that you would sacrifice to God anyway. Okay, these are animals you can eat. You wouldn't sacrifice them to God. Remember, wandering in the wilderness, there probably weren't too many gazelle and deer wandering around for you to shoot and eat, right? So it's not even really addressed in Leviticus, right? The clean and unclean it is, but pretty sure they didn't run into too many gazelle and deer in the Sinai Desert. Okay. Right, right. So, but in the land, you know, you might go hunting and you might catch a gazelle or deer and you don't have to cart it all the way to down Jerusalem because God doesn't want that as a sacrifice anyway. So you can kill it and eat it. The restriction, right, is that you are still not allowed to eat the blood. This is from Leviticus 17, 10 to 13. Leviticus 17, 10 to 13, the life is in the blood. They are never to eat the blood. So the blood has to be properly drained from the animal and then they can eat it. Okay, so even though this is not a sacrifice, they're still not to eat the blood.
So, remind me,
yeah.
In the wilderness, did they have quail the whole time?
No.
I didn't think so.
No, they wanted meat, and they complained about meat, and so God says, fine, I'm going to give you meat until you're sick of it.
They just had a short time.
Yeah. But they had it, I think they had it every day for a couple of months or something, if I remember correctly. I mean, it was until they, like, were so sick of the meat.
Right. So then the rest of it, let's say 37 years later.
Right.
The rest of that time, the only time they would eat meat was as part of a fellowship offer.
Right, right, right. I mean, I suppose they could have eaten something like a gazelle or a deer if they'd caught it, but I don't know that too many of those were running around. You know, however, in Canaan, it's going to be different. I mean, because this is an actual land that is not an arid desert. Okay, and I mean, I've driven across the Sinai Desert. There's not much there.
When they passed through, like, Edom and some of those other cities, yep. And he said, don't drink of their water.
Right.
Or you had to pay them.
Right,
or whatever,
right.
You know, but I don't remember them saying anything about meat specifically. He said, don't drink their water.
Right.
Don't.
Well, because water is at a high, I mean, that's the more valuable,
right.
But.
But it did say something about eating, but I think I thought there was something about vegetables, but not necessarily.
Yeah, I don't remember specifically, but yeah.
Yeah, because in the plunder list, they include a lot of.
Well, the cattle, they would, when they plundered, when they conquered Sihon and Og, right, then they got all the cattle and whatever. And then that's why Reuben, Gad, and half Manasseh wanted to settle Transjordan because they had gotten all this cattle as plunder and it was really good pasture land. So that's why they wanted to settle there. Yep.
Okay.
Verse 17, you are not allowed to eat within your gates the tithe of your grain or new wine or oil or the firstborn of your herd or flock or any of your votive offerings which you vow or your freewill offerings or the contribution of your hand. Anything that belonged to God, you had to take to Jerusalem. Okay? Right? Because 18, but you shall eat them before the Lord your God in the place which the Lord your God will choose. Okay? So the firstborn of everything belong to God, right? This is from Passover. The firstborn of your flock, that all belonged to God. You had to take that to Jerusalem, okay? Your tithe, your votive, a votive offering would be a vow, something you vowed to give to God, okay? And some of these, you might be allowed to eat part of it, okay? But anything that belonged to God, you had to take to Jerusalem, okay? You were not allowed to partake just within your town. Yes. Yes. Well, not Jerusalem specifically.
Okay.
Right? Because it just verse 5 is the first time. So chapter 12, 1 through 4 basically says you got to wipe out all other religions.
Right.
Cut down all their altars, smash it all, burn their idols, etc., etc. And then verse 5, but you shall seek the Lord at the place which the Lord your God will choose from all your tribes to establish his name there for his dwelling. And there you shall come. There you shall bring your burnt offerings, your sacrifices, your tithes, blah, 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 blah. Okay?
When do they actually name Jerusalem?
Jerusalem doesn't get chosen until 2 Samuel 5 with David.
So
yes.
In
yes. So because this is Deuteronomy, they're not in the land yet.
So what about all the 400 years in the land before?
Right. Then you just had the tabernacle, and it was at different places. Even though the tabernacle was not in Jerusalem, it was still always in one place.
Okay.
So if Israel even obeyed, which during Judges, I doubt that they did, right? Probably during Joshua, it says the people were obedient as long as the leaders, Joshua and his leaders were alive, right? At the end of Joshua, it says that. Judges, pretty sure they just did. Everyone did what was right. It says, because there was no king in Israel, everyone did what was right in his own eyes. So you needed a king to establish order, and that's what David comes in and does. Okay, so Jerusalem is not established until 2 Samuel.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, right. So here it just says the place God is going to choose a place.
And so you have to, by default, then conjecture that the place he chose in that 400 years before David and
yes.
Jerusalem is wherever.
Correct. Correct, correct. But God did have an ultimate destination in mind, but he was going to use a king to establish that, and the king didn't happen until, yeah. Yep, good question. Okay, so any of your sacrifices that belong to God, I turned the page and then I'm like, wait, it doesn't say what I wanted to say. Okay, right, you are allowed to eat before God, right, with your son, your daughter, this is the middle of verse 18, your male, female servants, and the Levite who is within your gates. Remember, you always had to share some with the Levite, right, because they didn't have an inheritance. They were to get the tithe, and then the priests were to get the tithe of the tithe, so that they were to get the top 10% of the 10%. So the top.
That much food left over, I mean, that the Levites get food?
Oh, yeah. Well, because, so everybody had to tithe 10%.
Oh.
Of their harvest, right? So 10%, I mean,
50 million people.
Well, it wasn't that many, but yeah, but the tribe of Levi was very small. And so you think it only takes 10 families to support one Levite, right? Which is not, I mean, to support one Levite to the extent to 100%, right? Which maybe they can survive on less. And then the Levites would take from their 10% that they got of everything, and they would take 10% of that and give it to the priests. And so the priests would get the best of the best. That's what they would get. Okay. But God had it set up. If they obeyed and did it the way God said it, they should, it would have worked out. Right? Well, no, they didn't. Okay. All right. So you're supposed to take care of everyone, but the point is your sacrifices, they have to go to Jerusalem, to that one place. Okay, verses 20 to 28, this basically repeats verses 15 to 19 with just a couple differences. Okay, so 20, when the Lord your God extends your border as he has promised you, okay? So you're going to go in and conquer the land, right? And you're going to have a first pass at it. And even then, you can eat meat in your cities. But as you grow, i.e. David, and as he conquers more, right? It was under David that Israel owned the most, right? Now Israel's getting even bigger, and you're getting even further away from Jerusalem, right? Okay, so when he extends your borders, it doesn't matter. You can still eat meat in your land. In your cities, okay? And verse 21, if the place which the Lord your God chooses to put his name is too far from you, then you may slaughter of your herd and your flock. So here it's added that not only can you eat the deer and gazelle, you can also eat your ox and your sheep and your goats. Okay, things, items that are sacrificial animals, right? If you have a hankering for steak that night, you can kill your bull, okay? You can slaughter your, even if he would technically, well, and not all sheep qualified as sacrificial animals anyway. They had to be very specific, 1 year old or whatever. So if you have an old ram that just needs to die, you know.
Or the ones with the blemishes.
Right, or the ones with the blemishes, right? You can eat those and it's no big deal. Okay? Again, the caveat is, and again, sorry, the clean and the unclean, because this is not a sacrifice to God, anyone can eat it. Verse 23, only be sure not to eat the blood. Okay, for the blood is in the life. You shall not eat the life of the flesh. You shall not eat it. Okay, emphasis, emphasis, emphasis. Don't eat the blood. So it doesn't matter when you kill an animal. You're not allowed to eat the blood. Make sure the blood is properly poured out on the ground. Okay. And again, verse 26, only your holy things, which you have taken, which you have, your votive offerings, you shall take and go to the place which the Lord chooses. Okay, so all your offerings have to go to the one place, to the tabernacle or to Jerusalem. Okay, whichever time period you're living in. Verse 28, be careful to listen to all these words which I command you, so that it may be well with you and your sons after you forever. For you will be doing what is good and right in the sight of the Lord your God. Okay, so Israel is to be careful to listen and obey. And this isn't just talking about eating a meat, right? This refers to from the beginning. They need to destroy all the Canaanite worship places. They need to make sure that they worship in Jerusalem alone or in the one place, okay? And then they need to make sure that if they're going to eat meat, that they properly dispose of the blood and that they don't eat any of the proper sacrifices in their cities, but they go to Jerusalem. Okay? 29 through 31, this is a final warning in this chapter. Again, don't worship like the Canaanites. When the Lord your God cuts off before you the nations which you are going in to dispossess, and you dispossess them and dwell in their land, beware that you are not ensnared to follow them after they are destroyed before you, and that you do not inquire about their gods, saying, how do these nations serve their gods, that I may do likewise? Okay? Israel's worship is to be different. They are to not worship willy-nilly on any hilltop and under any tree that they think is sacred. They were to worship in the one place that God chose. Okay. Even after Israel destroys Canaanite worship, it's still going to be a temptation. And we know it is, because Israel fails at this point over and over again. Canaanite worship is always a temptation, because unless your heart is changed, it is always going to stray after other things to worship. Okay. If they do this, this would be abandoning Yahweh, right? Verse 31, you shall not behave thus towards the Lord your God. Okay, for every abominable act which the Lord hates, they have done for their gods. For they even burn their sons and daughters in the fire to their gods. God hates the way the Canaanites worship. And this is part of the reason that Israel is getting the land. Remember, it was chapter 10. Chapter 9, where he says, Moses says to them, don't even think for half a second you're getting the land because you're righteous. You're not righteous, you're not righteous, you're not righteous, you're not righteous, right? And he goes on to tell them why they're getting the land. And part of the reason they're getting the land is because God is judging the Canaanites for partially how they worship. And he hates how they worship because they even sacrifice their children. Okay? They commit murder, sacrifice their sons and daughters to their gods, and God hates that. God is holy, murder is not. Okay, so Israel is to avoid this at all costs. All Canaanite worship, because God hates all of it. Any worship except for worship of him, God hates. Verse 32, whatever I command you, you shall be careful to do. You shall not add to nor take away from it. Okay, so God is supreme. and his word is to be obeyed explicitly. You're not to add to it. You're not to take away from it. You are to obey and obey fully. Questions, chapter 12. I think we can do the first section of chapter 13 in 15 minutes. Okay, chapter 15 deals with command 2, which is idolatry. This chapter gives us three situations or three types of people to deal with. It's kind of three situations, but it's kind of all just one. Okay, they're all very similar. Okay, so these are going to be three situations or three types of people who will tempt you towards idolatry. And what is Israel supposed to do? Okay, if they are going to live out creation theology and someone else tempts them to commit idolatry, how are you supposed to respond? Okay, so the first section, verse 1 through 5. Can someone read chapter 13, verse 1 through 5?
If a prophet or a dreamer of dreams arises among you and gives you a sign or a wonder, and the sign or the wonder comes true concerning what you spoke to you, saying, let us go after other gods whom you have not known, and let us serve them. You shall not listen to the words of that prophet or the dreamer of dreams, for the Lord your God is testing you to find out if you love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul. You shall follow the Lord your God and fear him, and you shall keep his commandments, listen to his voice, serve him, and cling to him. But that prophet or the dreamer of dreams shall be put to death, because he has counseled rebellion against the Lord your God, who brought you from the land of Egypt and redeemed you from the house of slavery, to seduce you from the way in which the Lord your God commanded you to walk. So you shall purge the evil from among you.
Okay, so first we have a religious leader. Okay, so prophet. This is somebody who hears words from God and tells them to the people. A dreamer of dreams. In the ancient Near East, it was very common for the gods to speak to men in dreams. Okay, this even happens in the Old Testament, right? Joseph had dreams, prophetic dreams. Solomon had dreamed. God appeared to Solomon in a dream when he says, what do you want? Right? Ask for anything and I'll give it to you. And Solomon asked for wisdom. Okay, so this is a way God used in the Old Testament to communicate with man, both prophets and dreamers. So neither of these are negative terms. Both of them are very positive. These are both ways that God would reveal things to man. Okay? So this is a religious leader, a prophet and a dreamer of dreams arise among you and gives you a sign or a wonder. So not only is he a prophet, a dreamer, he is a miracle worker. Okay? He has miraculous ability. The point is this man has great power and great authority, great influence. Okay? So far, verse 1, none of these things are negative. Okay, because God often allowed his prophets to have miraculous abilities to validate their message, right? I mean, think of Elijah and Elisha, right? They healed people, okay? Verse 2, and the sign or the wonder comes true concerning which he spoke to you, saying, let us go after other gods whom you have not known and let us serve them, okay? So this religious authority uses his miraculous ability to prove that Israel should serve other gods. Okay. Other gods. This is a clear indicator that this is a false prophet. No true prophet would lead Israel to break commands 1 and 2. But think of yourself in this situation. This is most likely a highly respected man, a religious leader, a religious authority, has miraculous power. Okay. And then on into his career, he says, hey, let's go serve other gods. Israel is a nation. What are you going to do? How do you treat someone like this? Okay? He says, there's a parenthetical insertion, whom you have not known. This is Moses' clarification of how absurd this idea is. Okay? That word for known, I'm pretty sure is that same word as a husband knows his wife. So this is more than just intellectual knowledge. This is experiential knowledge. You have an intimate relationship with. Israel has an intimate relationship with Yahweh. He has intervened in their history. They know him. They have seen his cloud and his fire, right? They have seen, he dwells with them at the tabernacle. I mean, they have an intimate relationship with Yahweh. Now a prophet comes along and says, hey, let's go serve another god, which Israel, you have no experiential knowledge of. you know nothing about. Yes, you might know who they are, who Baal is, and what he's supposed to do, but he has not interacted with you like Yahweh your God has. Okay, so this is not a God that you know. If Israel decides to serve other gods, right, it is a full rejection of Yahweh. And that's why later on in verse 5, right, again, God talks about bringing you from the land of Egypt, redeeming you from slavery. This is how intimate the relationship between Israel and Yahweh is, right? He plucked them out. He did something that has never been done in history before or since. Saved them from Egypt. And so for them to totally abandon him and go after another god, that is just full apostasy. You can't get worse than that. Okay? And that's what this prophet or dreamer is counseling Israel to do. Okay? Verse 3 and 4. You shall not listen to the words of that prophet or that dreamer of dreams, for the Lord your God is testing you to find out if you love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul. Okay? So they are to not listen. That listen means obey and follow, right? Say, oh, good idea. We'll go serve other gods. Okay, you're not to do that. And it says, it's clearly here that God is going to allow situations like this to arise. He is going to allow this to happen for a man of religious authority who has great power to tempt them like this. Why? It's a test to find out if you love the Lord your God, to show you what's in your heart. Right? Because God already knows what's in your heart. He doesn't need the test to know, but it's going to show you. Are you going to just follow along, or are you going to stand up against this false teacher? Okay. So the question is Israel going to pass the test to love and fear God only? And the sad answer is most of the time they do not. Okay. Israel is to follow Yahweh only. Okay, the covenant demands unswerving devotion, right? Verse 4, you shall follow the Lord your God and fear him. You shall keep his commandments, listen to his voice, serve him, and cling to him, right? This is all Yahweh God, not other gods. You are to align yourself with Yahweh God only, okay? So, Israel, what are you supposed to do? But that prophet or that dreamer of dreams shall be put to death, because he has counseled rebellion against the Lord your God, who brought you from the land of Egypt, redeemed you from the house of slavery, to seduce you from the way in which the Lord your God commanded you to walk. So you shall purge the evil from among you. Okay? So, what are you supposed to do with this very powerful, influential man? You're supposed to kill him. Okay? The penalty is extreme because the sin is extreme. Now, here's the problem. Someone read for me Deuteronomy 18, verse 18 and 19. Deuteronomy 18, verse 18 and 19.
I will raise up a prophet from among their countrymen like you, and I will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak to them all that I command him. It shall come about that whoever will not listen to my words, which he shall speak in my name, I myself will require it of him.
Okay, so this is talking about there's going to be another prophet like Moses. Okay, that's going to come and God's going to put his words in his mouth and he's supposed to speak, right? So this not only is going to apply to Jesus, it's also going to apply to other prophets, okay? Like in the back of the Old Testament, okay? And it says, verse 19, it shall come about that whoever will not listen to my words, because these are the very words of God spoken out of the prophet's mouth, right? Which he shall speak in my name, I myself will require it of him. If you don't listen, you're going to get the punishment. If you don't listen, God's going to hold you accountable, and he's going to bring whatever judgment on you that he said through the prophet. Okay, so now Israel's in a hard spot. Because in one part of Deuteronomy, it says, if there's a prophet, oh, you better listen and you better obey, right? Now you have but here you have a prophet that's saying, let's go follow other gods. Okay, so Israel might be like, oh, like, that's my boss. I'm supposed to do what he says, right? But you can see that there's going to be a struggle, right? So you have to be discerning. And also, the prophet's not going to say, let's go follow other gods. I mean, he's not going to say it that bluntly and that clearly, right? You're probably going to have to discern it from what he's saying. Because when are false teachers ever that blatantly blunt, right? They're not. Oh, let's go follow this other god that we don't know. Good idea. You know, they're not going to be that blunt. So Israel is going to have to discern. Yes, we have to obey prophets, but once prophets start counseling us to abandon Yahweh, Now we have to decide, nope, you're done, and we have to kill you. But Israel can't get it wrong, right? Because if they do, then maybe they've killed a real prophet. Okay, and that's never a good idea, which they do all the time. Okay, not a good idea. Okay, but as soon as the prophet starts promoting other gods, however slyly, however trickily, right, that's when his authority breaks down. Okay, idolatry is so extreme that you don't try to confront him and bring him to repentance, right? There's no three-step approach of Matthew 18 here, is there? No. If he's promoting other gods, he gets the death penalty and that's it. You're done. Okay? You get one strike, you're out. Okay? Because idolatry is that extreme. Because you are counseling, because you are in a position of authority and you are counseling an entire nation to abandon the God that has brought them out of Egypt, redeemed you from the house of slavery, right? And he is seducing you from the way in which the Lord your God commanded you to walk. So you shall purge the evil from among you. Okay? You must kill him. Right? And you have to get rid of the evil in Israel or it will spread. And so that's why the penalty is so harsh. Okay? This ties into the New Testament. Let's go to Matthew 7. Can someone read for me Matthew 7, verses 15 to 20? Okay, the next passage, right? The next verse, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only he who does the will of my Father, right? Many will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name? And in your name cast out demons. We did these miracles. And what's Jesus going to say? Depart from me, I never knew you, right? So here it says that there are going to be false prophets, right? And they're going to be tricky. They're going to be wolves, but they're going to be dressed up like sheep. And how do you know them? How do you know who is preaching the truth and who is not? How do you know who is a wolf in sheep's clothing? What does the Bible say? By their fruits. You watch their life. Give them enough time and it will be clear, right? They might fool you in the short term, but I mean, how many pastors have been brought down by adultery or tax evasion or fraud or whatever? You give them enough time and they'll hang themselves. Okay, but you have to be discerning. You have to watch out and you have to be able to identify those sheep, those wolves in sheep's clothing. Okay, now we're New Testament saints, so we're not going to go chop off somebody's head or stone them to death. Okay, but we have to have that same high standard saying we are going to follow God's word and we are not going to let anyone fool us. Okay, 1 John 4, last passage, and then we'll be done. 1 John 4. 1 through 6. First John 4, 1 through 6.
Beloved, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits to see whether they are from God, because many false prophets have gone out into the world. By this you know the spirit of God. Every spirit that confesses that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh is from God. And every spirit that does not confess Jesus is not from God. This is the spirit of the Antichrist, of which you have heard that it is coming, and now it is already in the world. You are from God, little children, and have overcome them, because greater is he who is in you than who is in the world. They are from the world, therefore they speak as from the world, and the world hears them. We are from God. The one who knows God hears us. The one who is not from God does not hear us. From this we know the spirit of truth and the spirit of error.
Okay, so there are going to be many false prophets, right? But we are to test the spirits, test them, right? And see what's going on, right? We don't just buy hook, line, and sinker anybody who claims to be a pastor, Christian teacher, and just swallow wholly what they say, right? We have to test them, right? Every spirit that confesses that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh from God. This is a big deal, right? Because there are, in the early church, there were so many controversies. How was Jesus 100% God and 100% man? And some believed that the flesh is evil, and so Jesus couldn't have come in the flesh because then that would have been evil, right? You have to believe the right things about Jesus. And every spirit that does not confess Jesus is not from God. This is the spirit of the Antichrist, right? Verse 5, they are from the world, therefore they speak as from the world, and the world listens to them, right? This can be a key indicator, right? Who are these people's biggest fan? Can anybody go to this church and feel okay and not get offended and think everything's okay, right? If the world can be okay with the pastor, there's a problem with the pastor, okay? Because the gospel is offensive to the world. It is an offensive message. And so if anyone can come in and be okay and not be offended even the slightest, there's a problem. The truth is not being preached there. We, in the New Testament, are to test the spirits. We are to be discerning. We are not to just buy into anybody who claims to be a pastor, teacher, preacher, right? We have to make sure that what they're saying is lining up with Scripture. We need to be discerning as the Israelites. And again, nobody comes up and says things blatantly, so bluntly wrong. Sometimes they do. Most often they don't, okay? And you have to pick up on the little hints and clues, but you have to know your Scripture well enough that you are able to do that.